Hello and welcome. I'm Jane Collins of Community and Environmental Sociology and Gender and Women's Studies here at UW. And I came to this talk all excited to hear Diane Elson, our speaker for today. And then I said to Myra as I came in the room, Myra Marks Ferry, I've been reading her for 40 years, for all my life. I'm older than 40. And Myra said, well, then why don't you introduce her? So I'm doing this without a curriculum vitae in front of me to tell you all of the details, but so it's going to be a very personal appreciation by way of introduction. I think my first memory of Diane's work came in the early to mid-70s when I was just starting graduate school and trying to figure out how gender intersected with development, and reading what was then a new idea about the new international division of labor, and came across her book with Ruth Pearson, Nimble Fingers Make Cheap Workers, which I think is probably the first articulation of the nimble fingers hypothesis about why in the new international division of labor women were playing such a critical role. Since that time, she has written, 25 books?
But
many, many books as well, covering different aspects of this topic, looking at the inequalities in development process with the waxing and waning of trends in the world economy. So today, at this lecture, she's going to be talking to a current financial crisis and the gender dimensions of it in the high-income countries. And then tomorrow, across the street, she'll be talking about the impacts on middle and low-income countries in terms of how the crisis is affecting women or the gender dimensions of the crisis. And then, on Thursday, at 12:20 in 8108 Social Science, she'll be holding a special seminar meeting in a smaller, more intimate setting where she'll be talking about these issues in even more detail. So it's just an incredible pleasure and privilege to have you here today to talk to us about this. I can't think of anybody whose views on it I would rather hear.
Thank you. Thanks for that very generous introduction. So let me begin by saying how very happy I am to be here, to meet again with some old friends, to put some faces to the names of the things that I've been reading. And I look forward to the discussions that we can have today and tomorrow. And I'm particularly glad that I have a chance to present you some work in progress. I was told was okay to be presenting work in progress, and it is very much work in progress, so I'm hoping in the discussions with you to find out where it doesn't seem very convincing, where I might need to steer in a different direction, or to learn about aspects of this issue that some of you may have been working on or know something about. So I'm very much looking forward to that. So let me begin. So, a couple of provocative questions to start off with. The first one, thinking about this global financial crisis, a crisis made by men. There's been quite a lot of newspaper articles raising this issue. I picked out one of them. This was one that was in the Washington Post in February the 11th, 2009, headlined in Banking Crisis Guys Get the Blame, More Women Needed in Top Jobs, Critics Say. And it was about a meeting in London in February the 10th of the UK Parliamentary Treasury Select Committee, calling before it some of the key people in who were running the British banks that had lost billions of dollars and had to be bailed out. And as you can see, the quote lists the names of all the people at that meeting. The first paragraph is the ones who were the people who ran the British banks. They were all guys, Fred, Tom, Andy, etc., etc., coming before a parliamentary committee, that parliamentary committee only had one woman on it, Sally, and so 19 people in the room, 18 of them men. And I found several other articles raising this same issue: is this a crisis made by men? So that was one provocative question to start off with. The second was, again, something that question raised a lot by some people in the UK not long after the financial crisis really hit, about this time last year, a recession hitting women hardest. So this is an article by Ruth Sutherland, who's the business editor of the Observer Sunday newspaper in the UK, and one of the serious broadsheet newspapers. And she's had a whole series of articles about the gender dimensions of the crisis, and this was one of her early ones. The real victims in this credit crunch ? Women, suggesting that in this recession, unlike in previous ones, women may be hardest hit in terms of job losses, and raising the question, could this downturn reverse the huge economic gains that women have made over the past decades? So these were the two questions I started off with, because I found that these were being raised in the press. There were women parliamentarians along the same lines, and some women's groups also raising the same kind of questions, arguing along the same lines. Of course, being an academic, I thought, is it quite so simple as that? And so I began to think about a framework for analysis, and I'll talk a little bit about this. To some people it may look like a matrix. To me it looks like a patchwork quilt, and a patchwork quilt that's still in process. So what you see there is deliberately got a lot of blank squares in it, and I'll be trying to attempt to fill in a little bit about some of these squares during the talk. But I began by thinking about the nature of the crisis, thinking about the origins, the proximate, but also some of the underlying reasons for the crisis, the impacts, both in the short run but also longer run impacts, and responses. And I'm going to focus on two kinds of responses, the households and states, although there are a range of other kinds of responses one might talk about as well, in terms of community or organised labour responses. And then I thought of the three sectors that I wanted to talk about. Finance, obviously, that's where things appeared to have started. Production, was the impact going to be on production? And social reproduction. And I've had a long sort of inner struggle about whether to use this label, social reproduction. I used it at a meeting in Oxford, organised by Oxfam at the beginning of last week. And then I had spent 15 minutes trying to explain what I meant by social reproduction. Perhaps I don't need to spend as long in this group, but I mean the non-market, unpaid activities that go on in households and communities, that reproduce us as human beings, and that also reproduce the labour supply for production and for finance. And I guess I've called it social reproduction rather than households and communities for two reasons. I think one is, and it reflects the reason I think why in feminist thinking we started to use this term, to get away from, if you use households and communities, people often think of that as a kind of private and as not part of the economy. And so I think we wanted to say, well, it has very public dimensions, even if it's not market and non-market. And we like to think of it as part of the economy in the sense that work goes on there, even though it's not market work, and it's work that's absolutely essential for the rest of the economy operating. But I'll be interested to hear anybody's comments on that. I'm going to give a talk in New York on Monday under the auspices of the United Nations Development Programme, and there I might relabel this families and communities, but I'll be interested to see people's views on that. So that's the framework that I'm trying to work with, and I have not myself done any new field work at all. I've been looking at secondary sources, both quantitative and some qualitative sources, but really just trying to put it together and also to keep pace with the changing nature of the crisis. I also want to signal, of course, an awareness of intersections and diversities, although I'm not going to be going into a lot of depth on any of these issues. But clearly, gender intersects with all of these other stratifiers, race, ethnicity, class, age, location. And if one were writing a book on this, one would want to go into these in a lot more detail. I guess I will be focusing quite a bit on the issues for lower income women and men. And my focus is really, when I realised I'd said high income, when push came to shove, I was really talking about Anglo-Saxon capitalism, UK, USA, and to some extent Ireland, where I was at the end of August talking with people. And the trajectory in, say, Germany and France is a bit different. I haven't done any work on Iceland, which also turns out to have been suspiciously like Anglo-Saxon capitalism, although I never thought of that before. And there are some countries which are often classified as Anglo-Saxon capitalism, which have had a somewhat different trajectory, like Australia, where I spent 3 months in the summer. So that's something that might come up in discussion. Okay, so now I'm going to start on my patchwork quilt and talk a little bit about the proximate origins in the financial sector, where I think more or less everybody knows what they think about that. It's all conventional wisdom, it's reckless bankers, it's regulatory and credit rating failures. And within that, one can, of course, raise the issue of the gender division of labour in finance, that issue again of who's been taking the decisions. And this is a quote from Nicholas Krustoff in the New York Times about a discussion that was had at the World Economic Forum in Davos, probably involving some of the people who'd actually been reckless bankers or responsible for the regulatory failures, talking about, well, would it have been different if Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Sisters or Lehman Brothers and Sisters? In other words, that same idea that the crisis, the proximate sort of origins of the crisis are in a sector of the economy which is extraordinarily dominated by men, and which women have made less inroads than they have in many other sectors of the economy to high-level decision-making positions, and in which the gender inequalities are still very much of a very egregious kind. There has just been a new report launched in London on gender inequality in the city of London, and the gender gap in earnings is bigger than any other sector of the economy. And the kind of practices that are not tolerated now in any other sector of the economy, in terms of sexual harassment, for instance, seem to be alive and well in the city of London. There have been several very high-profile sexual harassment suits brought by women employed there. So that might be one thing one might explore. Clearly, it is a sector in which men have been much more dominant in decision making in high level positions, but is that enough? Just to point to that. Another thing that people have talked about is gender norms, the kind of macho culture that seems to be prevalent in the city of London, in Wall Street, and in this case in Iceland. This is to illustrate this. This is another clip from Ruth Sutherland, the business correspondent, business editor of the Observer newspaper, writing in February this year, arguing that the Iceland's financial disaster was caused by a macho, an overwhelmingly male business culture in the banking sector, and that in Iceland after the crisis, then women were brought in. Two guys who had been heading key banks that had gone bankrupt, gone bust, they were thrown out, and two women were brought in to head the banks, and with this idea that they are going to change the culture, injecting values of openness, fairness, and social responsibility. So there's also been this talk about it's not just about the issues of the numbers of men and women, something you might think of as the gender division of labour and decision making. It's also about the kind of culture that prevails, so that even if women are there, they only survive by adapting to this macho culture. And as somebody said in a seminar we were in Oxford last week, somebody has raised the question, challenged this, and said, wasn't it more to do with the kind of financial models that they use to evaluate risk, and whether it was men or women there, if they use those kind of mathematical models which they thought were telling them that none of this was particularly risky, whether they were men or women operating them wouldn't have made much difference. But then somebody else argued, well, maybe if there hadn't been such a macho culture and there'd been more women there, there would have been a different style of banking without so much reliance on these kinds of mathematical models to evaluate risk. And there has been, in discussion in the financial sector more broadly and before the crisis, an issue about whether gendered norms lead to different risk-related behaviours, whether some people have the idea that in financial decision-making maybe women tend to be more risk-averse because of various norms about responsibility and about practical issues too, about having to take care of elder relatives or of children. Others argued it's not such a matter of gender differences in risk aversion, but in risk awareness, and that women are more aware of a greater range of risks and depth of risk, and having that awareness may or may not lead them to be more risk averse. So that was another angle of investigation. And I think there are some interesting issues one could look at there, but I think one shouldn't just focus on the issue of the proximate origins of the financial crisis. Of course, I think it has underlying causes. I'm particularly going to focus on underlying causes of this particular financial crisis, but in doing so, I want to make the point that, of course, financial crisis and economic recession is not a new thing. It happens every so often. Goes right back to the beginnings of the capitalist system. The 19th century is punctuated by financial crisis and economic recession. It's the stuff of Victorian novels about families losing everything in the financial crisis, or the recession coming and hitting Manchester, where I lived for many years, and provoking labour unrest in response to it. So it's not a new thing. It seems to be hardwired into the way that capitalist economies work. But there's a whole lot of things one could say about that. Why is that the case? But I particularly wanted to draw attention to this crisis, which in post-war crises, of course, is unique in having its origins in the rich countries rather than in lower income countries. And I think it is related to global shifts in investment and production, global competition putting global pressure on, downward pressure on wages. So if you look around the world, in most regions, the growth of productivity is not matched by the growth of real wages. It is an era, prior to the crisis, of rising female labour market participation around the world, which, of course, on one hand we can celebrate as something which is very important for improving women's rights and autonomy, but it's also sobering to think that one of the reasons why this has happened is because average households have needed more than one income to stay above the poverty line. And also that most women entering into the labour market don't get what I call their breadwinner jobs and wages, as kind of shorthand for the sort of good jobs with social protection and a steady and high level and increasing level of wages that will support several people. And indeed, fewer men have got breadwinner jobs. So we've got that situation in which gender gaps in labour markets have been narrowing in terms of things like participation rates and even in terms of wage gaps in some countries. But in a context in which labour rights for both men and women are under pressure and deteriorating. So that the share of national income going to work has been falling in many countries, and listing the regions there, and consumption growth in high-income countries has only been sustained by credit. And I think particularly USA, UK and Ireland, the credit card culture with very high levels of household debt, which has sustained this and has masked downward trends in median real wages. So I think we have to look at financial crisis in this deep context of what's been happening to production and wages. And then I'd particularly like to explore a little bit further in terms of underlying causes, a link between debt and social reproduction, particularly in the USA, UK and Ireland, and particularly as it relates to housing. I think in all these countries, public housing availability has been falling and home purchases have been expanding and home loans have been expanding. Notice I don't say home ownership has been expanding, because I think there's an ideology that what people are getting is home ownership, but actually what they're getting is a lot of debt. And most people don't actually own their houses until late on in their lives, when they spent 25 years, 30 years paying off a debt. Much more so in USA, UK and Ireland than I say in Germany and France. Not so sure about Spain, I haven't looked at that at all. And we know for a long time before the crisis, house prices were rising, this kind of fictional wealth itself encouraging growth in consumer debt as people cashed out on some of the equity in their houses to go on to buy consumer durables or pay for health costs, I guess, in the United States. In the USA, as you all know, the subprime loans with these teaser rates, these low rates when you start them off, extended to particularly to borrowers who are perceived by the financial community as more risky, with women household heads and African Americans, and particularly African American women household heads being overrepresented in the so-called subprime loans. And for these loans, access is easier, but the terms are more onerous over the life of the mortgage. So that I think my data here comes from work that Brigitte Young has been putting together on this, and a paper by her I posted on the website of the Haven Center. It starts off easier to repay, but since the interest rates go up over the life of the loan, it takes a lot more to repay than a regular loan. And apparently women borrowers in the USA have been more likely to receive subprime loans than men at every income level. So it's not just that women have got lower incomes, and that's the reason why they're disproportionately represented in the subprime loans. And I was remembering how when I was young, we had to fight for women to be able to get mortgages in their own right. And when I was young, you couldn't get a mortgage. Your husband or your father or some man had to sign as the guarantor, and we fought that battle, and we got the right to have a loan in your own name without a male guarantor, but bit of a Pyrrhic victory for many women, because you were still perceived as a more risky borrower and not having access to loans on the same terms. In the UK, we didn't call it the subprime market, but we had what in retrospect was really crazy, lending to people at high percentages of their annual income at 105% of the purchase price of the house, and it was all predicated on the idea that house prices would go on rising, and so people would make a capital gain, and also these houses, the assets on the books of the banks, that the prices of them would carry on rising. But clearly nobody who ran the banks really had studied any economic history, because history, again, of capitalism is punctuated by asset price bubbles that then collapse. And as this one did. I'm interested in exploring, and I don't know whether anybody has yet, whether there is at all a link between the rise in the defaults in the subprime market and the fuel and food price rises that started to come in 2007, because preceding the financial crisis, there were rises in fuel and food prices, were particularly onerous in lower income countries, as I'll say something about tomorrow. But a question for me that I haven't seen anybody really investigating yet, but I'll be on the lookout for that, is whether there's any link between the rise in defaults in the subprime market and those rises in fuel and food prices. So when I'm thinking about the gender dimensions of the financial crisis, I think I want to get beyond thinking about is it a crisis made by men because they're the ones who dominate and their macho culture is the one that dominates the financial sector, to think more in terms of the link between social reproduction and high finance and the way in which social reproduction for so many middle and lower income families become predicated on high levels of debt, both for consumer spending and for their housing. And then, particularly the housing debt, there's a lot of financial innovation, which of course sounds incredibly positive, but what it meant was slicing and dicing all of these mortgages to create new assets on the back of these mortgages, which were given AAA ratings by the organisations like Moody's and Standard & Poor's that give ratings to financial instruments. Of course, they had a mixture of so-called kind of good mortgages and less good mortgages. And by 2006, the stability of the international financial system did depend on the ability of low and middle income holders of subprime mortgages to service their debt. And this spread way beyond the USA and the UK because of the way that banks were being globalized and there were international markets for these derivative financial instruments. So, quoted there what James Crotty at UMass Amherst has had to say about this, that the problems in the housing market and the subprime defaults meant that the collapse of the derivative financial instruments based on the mortgages collapsed, and via the global capital market that had knock-on effects or throughout the banking system of the well-off countries, even the ones like Switzerland and Germany and France that hadn't had the same kind of bubbles in their housing markets and hadn't had quite the same kind of predication of social reproduction and high levels of indebtedness, they got a contagion effect through their banking system. So the risk was offloaded from Wall Street and the City of London to homes throughout the world, but particularly those of middle and low income people. So I think that's the way I'd like to see the gender dimensions of the financial crisis, is not get beyond a perhaps more superficial look in terms of counting the numbers of men and women that were in the room when the crucial decisions were taken. In terms of the impact of the crisis, well, in the financial sector, I think we all know that there was the credit crunch, so loans were not rolled over and credit became very hard to find. I haven't seen any research yet, or perhaps even look for it, on whether there's a gender dimension to that. If you're running a small business and credit becomes a lot harder and your loans aren't rolled over as they were in the past, has that been more difficult for women-owned businesses than for men-owned businesses? Maybe it has, if women are perceived as more risky borrowers. Similarly, the same would go for ethnic minority borrowers. I think that might be an interesting question. Some job loss, of course, as well in the financial sector, and has there been a gendered pattern to that? And those are short-run effects, but in the longer run, well, there's been the ongoing sort of promise, the rules are going to change, we're not going to let this happen again. But as the crisis wears on, I am less and less and less optimistic that there really is going to be any substantial change in the rules. The bonus culture seems to be back, banks that have survived the immediate onslaught not too keen on the rules being changed very much, and although there's quite an interesting discussion going on between Anglo-Saxon capitalism and social market capitalism on this issue, I'm far less optimistic that it's going to be much of a change in the rules, or indeed much of a change in the cultural norms of the banking system either. Notice that it's only Iceland that's put women in charge of trying to clean up the banks. And I don't see really much sign that women's employment rights in the sector are going to be improving. Let's have a look now about the impact of the crisis in production. Obviously the short run impact because of the credit crunch has been loss of employment and worsening conditions of employment, shorter hours, lower earnings, lower benefits. I understand lower earnings is something that comes close to home here, in that although people haven't lost their jobs in the public sector in Wisconsin, there's been a de facto loss of earnings through enforced holidays, something like that. Yeah. Declining returns in self-employment, increase in bankruptcies. In the long run, of course, people have raised the issue, well, would this be an opportunity to restructure production, to address challenges of climate change, fuel security, food security, and the care crisis associated with aging the population? A lot of question marks there, because I don't see that happening. And that would be the optimistic scenario, that there could be opportunity for this. And the pessimistic scenario is it will be a restructuring of a different sort, with even more onslaught on labour rights and a greater growth of precarious employment than before. But if we look at the gender dimensions of that, and thinking back to my second slide with Ruth Sutherland saying, is this a recession in which women are going to be hit hardest? If we look at the unemployment data, it doesn't bear out her concern, the data for last year. So last year, UK, Jan to October, the data from the Office of National Statistics, male unemployment rose from 5.6% to 6.6%. It's a lot higher than that now. Female unemployment rose. It was always a bit lower than men's in the UK, and it's gone up to 5.6%. So, no, the answer would be if you looked at the unemployment figures, you would not see it a recession in which women in the UK were bearing the job loss more than men. But at the end of this data, it showed that the rate of increase of unemployment for women was approaching that of men. And the new report from the Trade Union Congress, which I haven't yet had time to look at, suggests that the recession has spread to new sectors of the economy. It's spread beyond construction and the car industry, and is having a significant impact on the retail sector, in which lots of women work. So, and for reasons I'll come on to later, next year we're expecting there to be declines in public sector employment, and so with this pack, this might turn out to be a short-run impact that might look somewhat different by the middle or the end of next year. I was looking at an ILO report that was looking at data from several of the rich countries, including the USA. That's why my data there is from the ILO. And that seemed to suggest that the UK picture for last year was pretty much similar in many of the other rich countries. So the data for the USA was that male unemployment rose by 1.7 percentage points to reach nearly 8%, and female unemployment rose by 1.1 percentage points to reach nearly 6.5%, with of course the key reason being that the sectors that were hardest hit are the ones that tend to employ more men than women, construction in particular. But just two problems to note. There is an issue that women's unemployment is more likely to be undercounted than men's. Discouraged worker effect is often stronger for women. And time frame matters. It may be that the early impact is on the more male-intensive industries, but the later impact would come on the more female-intensive service industries. But I think we'd have to say you can't make simple argument that the recession is having more impact on women's jobs than men's. If you look not at unemployment but at job loss, which is another indicator, and that means that you don't have to worry about that discouraged worker effect, this is some data that the Trades Union Congress in the UK was quoting in the report it issued in January 2009 on male and female redundancy rates from 1997 to 2008. And the blue line is male and the red line is female, and you can see it's been higher for men than women, reflecting the higher unemployment rates in the UK for men than women. Has been on a downward trend since the recovery from the recession of the early 2000s, but of course it goes up in 2008, but it goes up at a higher rate for women than for men. So although it starts off at a lower level for women, the gap is narrowing, and in January to September 2008, female rates increase at double the rate for men. But beyond looking at the numbers, looking at the gender divisions in terms of sex disaggregation of statistics on different dimensions of employment and unemployment, I think it's important to look at gendered norms in employment. There's certainly a possibility of discrimination, illegal discrimination against women in selection for redundancy. It is illegal, for instance, in the UK, but there are reports that employers are putting pressure on pregnant women and women on maternity leave. They're being selected for redundancy, bullied into resigning, given downgraded jobs if they try and return from maternity leave, for instance, being told, no, you can't come back on a part-time basis, even though that had been agreed before. You can't come back with family-friendly employment conditions, even though that had been agreed before. And with this view that if it's a recession, really it's men that should have priority in the employment, and that pregnant and women and women on maternity leave, their rights take second place. And I wondered whether, in fact, the recession might strengthen these kinds of gender norms. There was a question in the World Values Survey in 2005 about asking when jobs were scarce, did they agree that men have more right to a job than women when jobs are scarce? And 40% of those interviewed agreed. Seems to me that might be the kind of gender norm that's going to be reinforced and intensified in the kind of recession we've got. There's also an issue about gendered rights. I don't know what it's like in the USA, but in the UK, women are less likely than men to qualify for unemployment benefits. For some, it's because they earned when they were in employment less than the threshold for compulsory contributions to social insurance, which is a condition for access to unemployment benefits. Not access to sort of basic income benefits, but access to unemployment benefits. So women who work part-time, lots of women work part-time in the UK, might not, especially if they were older women, have made the contributions that entitle them to unemployment benefit. But another is because after the first 6 months of social insurance-based benefit, you move on to a different kind of benefit, which is a means-tested benefit rather than a social insurance-based benefit. And it's means-tested on household, not individual income. And in the UK, it turns out that unemployed women are more likely to have an unemployed partner than unemployed men are. And so they wouldn't be likely to be qualified. So women, for those kinds of reasons, are less well placed to withstand. They get less cushion from the unemployment benefits. And of course, we don't have nearly as good unemployment benefits in the UK as they do in a country like Germany or France. Let me turn now to the negative impact on social reproduction. I think it's obvious in the short run that there's a decline in household incomes for many people. There's an increase in repossessions of homes. There's a decline in asset values, the house has gone down, the pension value has gone down. I know that's a big issue here because you have these pensions which are defined contribution pensions rather than defined benefit pensions. Decline in interest on savings of older people and retirees, so pressure on income and asset values, leading again in the longer run to probably declines in what economists like to call human capital, as opposed to financial capital. In other words, declines in health, declines in educational achievements, people dropping out of school at all levels, declines in health, the pressure on mental health, the pressure on here, I think, although not in the UK, of losing your health insurance and then not seeking treatment until it's too late. Even in the UK, where despite what you may have heard on these right-wing talk shows, everybody has the access to the National Health Service, which is actually in much better shape now than it was 10 years ago. The declines in mental health, I think, are already starting to show. And I think, especially, you would expect to see this in most deprived social groups, but I don't know whether in rich countries like the UK or the USA you would expect to see any gender differences there. We'll come tomorrow to some of these longer-run impacts in the poorer countries where you would expect to see, based on past evidence, gender differences in things like educational dropout or a decline in access to healthcare. I'd be interested to hear what people think about that, but I'm not aware that there's likely to be a gender difference there. I think the class and the race ethnicity difference is probably likely to be stronger. How do households respond? So I now want to start talking about from impact to responses and talk about a little bit about, first about household responses. I think one response one tends to see is back to thrift, reduce consumption, increase savings, increase unpaid work. And I'll be saying a little bit more about the issue of unpaid work when I try and pick out some of the gender divisions. But make do and mend. Make food at home rather than go to the restaurant. Make food at home rather than buy in fast food. Grow your own vegetables. Cutting sleep. And that has impacts on mental health. Now, all of these reactions, all of these responses, these thrifty responses, may help individuals and individual families survive, although that's not guaranteed because there's a limit to what you can do through these measures to survive. My thrift contributes to a downward spiral in your paid economic activity. I think this is what Keynes emphasizes, the paradox of thrift. My response to the crisis is going to be thrifty, but that's going to put you out of a job. If you've already got a job, you'll be out of a job because I will spend less on dry cleaning, I will spend less on fast food, I will spend less on going out to the restaurant. I'll expand my unpaid work and try and keep up the well-being of my family through doing more unpaid work, but that'll tend to put a lot of other people out of jobs. And so the paradox of thrift is that individual thrift is that